We talk about the Knicks winning playoff games with what feels like four players. We discuss coaches' challenges, coaches being hired, and the rest of the coaching rumor mill. And we answer questions about some of the teams that have been eliminated from the playoffs. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter at Yahoo Sports. Joining me as always is my man. It's your man. It's everyone's man. It's Dan Devine. Fresh off another exhilarating victory at Madison Square Garden. The vibes are high. The city of Manhattan and all of the boroughs are abuzz. How you doing, buddy?
They are constitutionally incapable of playing a boring game, it seems. Like there's no, it's not just like, well, one team got out to a lead and then held it and nothing interesting happened, just a basketball game. Like, I'm so envious of our colleague Ben Rohrbach, covered Celtics Cavs, and his story was like few hundred words that was like, is anybody going to give the Celtics a game? And then I was like, it's a good angle and it was well done and well executed, but I was like, you were able to figure that out like in the second quarter and just hammer it.
Yeah.
And I feel like I am like trying to plug holes in a dam every time I'm writing about the Knicks because everything's insane until the last minute. Jalen Brunson's foot died, but then Jalen Brunson's foot came back to life. 54 years to the day after Willis Reed's coming out of the tunnel, Jalen Brunson comes out of the tunnel. a 2.5 minute, dramatic theater monologue by Rick Carlisle about officiating imbalances. A lot happening in Madison Square Garden, but the sum total of it is Knicks 2, Pacers none. Knicks 2 wins away from their first Eastern Conference Finals appearance since 2000. Wild, wild times.
There we go. I mean, you took our little fun intro and just like went into the expository. So thank you for doing my job for me. And to your credit, like, you're not really going to be able to know what to write at a Knicks game until the final buzzer, when Josh Hart is reaching into Reggie Miller's headset and saying, hey, Reggie, the crowd? Yeah, they're chanting, fuck you. So I don't know how you could possibly script that in the second quarter and be ahead of things.
It's really hard. Like, if somebody had asked me yesterday morning, like, wait, what's something Josh Hart could do to further endear himself to the people of New York? Like, I don't know, man. He literally never stops playing. He plays like a 6'4" Giannis. And he gives great answers in press conferences and at his locker, and he's very funny. So like, I don't know what he could do that would be more endearing. And then he cursed at Reggie Miller on live TV, and like, it's hard to imagine something that makes Knicks fans happier than that, outside of maybe seeing TJ McConnell go to the bench. Those are the two things that make Knicks fans happiest right now.
We were talking about it before we went live and trying to troubleshoot some things, how like, like the differences of covering a game at the game versus the fact that, like, ostensibly to the overwhelming majority of the population that is consuming these games, this is a TV show.
Right.
And Josh Hart is an incredible character in the TV show. The fact that, like, it was also a story that TNT flew Reggie Miller in specifically for this game. He'd been doing other games, and Josh put a little nice salty, you know, thing on top, was pretty awesome. But to the basketball.
Yes.
I picked the Knicks in five, and I'm not here to gloat because we're only two games in and anything could happen.
Sure.
But I say that to say that when the lovely graphic that has come out on all of our predictions that we just, we're just so clairvoyant that we're capable of predicting and seeing every single little thing from a game seven to a whole series, but that's just a whole nother thing. Someone texted me like, et tu, Brut? About my Knicks and five take. And my answer was like, these guys just win games. Like, sure, they had their own debacle at home in game five against Philadelphia, but the Sixers felt more like they couldn't outlast New York, I think, than the other way around. And I don't think that's particular to Philadelphia and Joel Embiid. I think that is just, there's something in the water. There's something in how these guys hustle. And it's so cliche. It is the talking point stuff that is taken right out of Tom Thibodeau's diaries and journals, and that every team slaps on the cinder blocks in the hallways of their practice facilities and whatnot. But it's just the truth with this team. And whether, I mean, I will just say from the jump, we talked about Brunson's foot dying, coming back to life. There's going to be a point in time, there has to be a point in time where the injuries do add up. And I wonder when that is, because it might be like 20 games from now, which obviously they could take care of things. You know where I'm going. I say that to say, they better hope they close this thing out in five, because the battle of attrition, that they are definitely losing, even though the victory stuff keeps coming. But I'm a little worried, and I don't want to pour cold water on all the Knicks love.
I think
it is of the utmost importance that they continue to do exactly what they're doing for that particular reason.
Yeah, I mean, there's no, like, when we were in the interview room at Madison Square Garden, you know, Tom Thibodeau comes in, talks to the media, and then the PR folks are getting ready to say, like, well, these are the players that are going to come in. And somebody says, like, oh, we don't know who it's going to be yet. And I was like, they only have like four fucking players left. Like, it's at a, you know, process of elimination. Brunson's going to be there, and one or both of DiVincenzo and Hart are going to be there. And that's kind of all that's healthy except for Isaiah Hartenstein. So yeah.
Who, by the way, is like dealing with this Achilles tendinopathy, or I don't know exactly what his condition of the Achilles is, but it's something I've been dealing with myself for like 4 years now, as my body depreciates in its own right. And I asked him about it after one game, not on a like reporting level, just at a, hey, I'm dealing with this, can I get any tips what like an NBA training staff is telling you to do? He's like wrapping his Achilles in, I guess I am reporting it now. He's wrapping his Achilles in like heat pads and doing like load bearing stuff, like whenever he is on the bench during timeouts, like going up to the basket and doing calf raises and whatnot. So he's not even like healthy either.
And there's a component of that that is like, you get to May and nobody's healthy, right?
Yes.
But they're like extra not healthy.
The story of their year.
And Tom Thibodeau is very adamant about reminding you of that. You know,
yes,
we've been shorthanded all year. We lose Mitch early. You know, we get OG Anunoby. We lose Randall. We lose OG. We get, Bojan, and then we lose him. You know, like on and on and on down the line. And that's like, so that's the context of that you're talking about, where you're like, it's not just, well, the Knicks didn't develop a bench, you know, it's the Knicks are down three starters. If OG Anunoby, who pulled up in the, with about 3.5 minutes left in the third quarter last night, running out in transition, lunging for a ball to go try to put up a layup, immediately reaches for his left hamstring, pulls up and like kind of race walk waddles out of the game and straight to the back and is ruled out for the rest of the night. So Tom Thibodeau, after Mitchell Robinson, his stress reaction to the, you know, every aggravation of his ankle, you know, surgically repaired ankle, is now out for, I mean, they didn't say for like fully out for the season, but they said reevaluated in 6 to 8 weeks, and it's May 9th. So, you know, you do the math on that and it's, you know, his season's effectively over. No Randall, no Bogdanović, no Mitchell Robinson, and the status for OG Anunoby very much up in the air. Like, I think it is completely fair to say, how much more can you ask of players who are already giving you so much?
Yes.
And that is what, I mean, the Nova Knicks, you know, who you wrote, you know, wonderfully about their relationship and how they sort of grew together.
Thank you.
Those guys are... like, Josh Hart is literally playing every second. He has not come off the court in 10 quarters.
Yeah.
Dante DiVincenzo, what, you know, because he was struggling in the Philly series, that those struggles are behind him, and he is now playing like 45 minutes a night. Brunson went from missing 15 minutes of the first half with the right foot soreness to playing the entire second half, all 24 minutes of it, on that injured right foot. Like, you're absolutely right. The war of attrition at some point has to come back. You know, you can't just win that forever. And I asked TJ McConnell about that during his post-game press conference last night. I said, like, do you find yourself at any point thinking, like, just at a certain point, this has to come back on these guys? They can't keep going on like this for much longer. And TJ McConnell, a consummate professional, is like, I mean, if we don't turn things up a bit, then they can. Like, it is on us to make that hurt for them. It's on us to, so the first part was a quote, this part I'm paraphrasing, but it's on us to make them exert this energy, to make it like impossible for Jalen Brunson to play 45 minutes on a bad foot, getting 110 touches a game on a 40% usage rate, right? Like, it's on us to make it so that Josh Hart at some point runs out of juice, like whatever. Mm-hmm. And to this point, the Pacers have not been able to do that. The Knicks playing 6.5 guys 45 minutes a game are the ones who are fresher and more energetic and more physical late in these games. The number that's insane here, and there's a bunch of them, but the Knicks have rebounded in the second half of these first two games. They have rebounded 58.3% of their misses. The Knicks that's led crazy. The league this season in offensive rebounding rate at 33%. So significant jump in the second half of these games when every loose ball is like lifeblood. And the Pacers know they need to get one of these games to get home court advantage and lean on a weakened, shorthanded team. And the Knicks are just not letting them do it. So, yes, you're right. At a certain point, it's going to come back to them. At a certain point, it's going to catch up with them.
Or it might not. Who's to say? That's we can't say I'm
like,
that.
I'm like, it has to happen, right? Yeah. And I think the most likely answer is, if it doesn't happen in this series, it certainly happens against the Celtics in round three. But that is not the way that Tom Thibodeau or his avatars on the roster think. Mm-hmm. They don't think about what's going to happen in three games. They barely think about what's going to happen in three possessions. They are just like, what is the next thing? I need as much as you can give me right now. And I think Brunson going from questionable to return with the foot soreness to I am going to give it a try. The way he put it was, I had a decision to make, so I made a decision. And he got out on the court and he started warming up and he figured out how much he could give and where he could go in a few possessions of being off the ball and getting back in the flow. And then he was just a hot knife through butter for the entire rest of the second half. Like, that is where the leadership comes from. That is where the everybody else raises their level because they see he's doing that in that way. And also, everybody is four guys. So you don't need that many guys to play so well because there's only so many of them there that are constantly on the floor. And so far, so good somehow.
Yeah. So a couple more thoughts on what you just said. Josh Hart, I see the statistic in the rundown. First player to play an entire playoff game four times in a postseason since Tom Thibodeau coached Jimmy Butler in 2013. That was Jimmy Butler's second year. He was 23. Josh Hart, a little bit older, 28. So that's like one little, but the guy does seem to just run on Sour Patch Kids and not need anything more.
It's Mike and Ike's. He's got a branding partnership there.
In that one post-game interview, but in a previous situation in Philadelphia in the post-game locker room, I saw one of the Knicks PR staffers bring him three boxes of candy. He chose two of them.
See, here
and left her one. And
I'm questioning
one of them was
your firsthand reporting. Brutal of me. I apologize. Exactly. Sorry for having offended.
Exactly. But back to the on-court stuff. I mean, the OG injury was definitely part of why I wanted to address this stuff, being that, I mean, he did exactly what I think New York was hoping OG would be capable of from a creator, driver, playmaker standpoint, a role that he had been purportedly looking for when he was considering his own exit out of Toronto. And it kind of was like a really nice snapshot of like, oh yeah, this is why this guy was held up as such a valuable commodity on the trade market for 2 years by the Raptors, why the Knicks ultimately felt it was worth giving up Emmanuel Quickley and RJ Barrett for, and why he's going to be potentially in line for a massive, massive payday this summer. So that was cool to see that like the confluence of all that was kind of like coming to the occasion and rising to it. I guess I wanted to say rising to the occasion to begin with, but there you go. I was just going to give a shout out to Precious, and then
absolutely get there quickly. That was something that Tibbs identified in the post game last night was like, it's not just that OG was so super aggressive, although he was, and it's not just that he had scored more points than he had since he first put on a Knicks uniform, which he had. It's that he did a little bit of everything. You know, they were running him in dribble handoff two-man games with Isaiah Hartenstein. He was getting downhill, driving to the rim. Sometimes it can be an adventure when OG dribbles. He was decisive and getting downhill to the basket and you know, being able to finish through contact, running the floor, hitting threes, good in transition, all of it. Like, you saw the outline of what I think a lot of people have wondered if he could ever be that consistently. And as you know, you have reported and other people have reported, like, he feels confident that he can be that if given the opportunity. And the initial structure of the Knicks, as you know, with Julius Randle there and other guys there, that's not what was required of him. But in the, you know, we need everything from everybody, and OG had a little bit more in the bag and he showed it. And it's just unfortunate that you know, he wasn't able to actually see that game out, because the Knicks certainly could use more of it.
Yeah, when, to the adventure point, when he gets in the paint, he kind of has a little bit of a tendency to do this like whirling pivot of, oh, I'm going to go into a fade. No, I'm not going too far from the mic. I'm going to go away from the rim, or I'm going to go to the rim. And he gets kind of caught in the, his own blender of decision making there. But one, just and I want to get to Rick Carlisle's complaining.
Sure.
Precious Achiuwa came over in that deal with OG, and he's kind of had an interesting arc as both a player and like a quote unquote trade asset from like a market value standpoint, being that, you know, he was one of the, he was a kind of token blue chip prospect in theory that went back to Toronto for Kyle Lowry in that sign and trade. And there was some talk about, like, at that point in time, there was some talk about what the future upside of him was compared to Tyler Hero. And kind of disappointed, I would say, a little bit in the Raptors from people who were high on him. And when he got to New York, like, someone who I know who used to be around Precious a lot, let's say, was saying to me, this is going to be really good for him because Tibbs is going to make sure that he maximizes himself on the defensive end and doesn't play outside of his own capabilities on offense. So that's kind of, that had kind of been some of the limitations for him previously, you know, trying to get a little too fancy with the dribble, maybe falling in love a little bit too much with jacking threes, and, you know, they help stretch the floor. That's what you told me to do. And there was one play, it must have been in, during that second quarter run, I'm blanking exactly when it was, but off an offensive rebound, off another Knicks offensive rebound scramble, of course it was, the ball got kicked out to Precious on the left wing. And I felt like Precious pre-Knicks trade would have been putting that thing up, baby. And he held it with the right amount of touch and acting chops or whatever to convince whoever was rotating that he was chucking that thing. And then he just, boop, kicked it over to the corner of OG, and he knocked that thing down. And like, that's something that is so small, but it's a massive growth point for him in particular, that I think is one thing of many things that summed up to the point where when the Mitchell Robinson news came out, I was disappointed for him, of course. But my first reaction after that was like, Precious, I think, has got this when needed. Like, he's not going to be able to play 28 minutes probably of like super high level NBA playoff basketball right now. But for the 12 to 18, they need him to do that. I think it's a really interesting and cool opportunity for him that he's so far seasoned pretty well. And I mean, if you want, yeah.
No, that's good.
Yeah. Okay. Rick Carlisle complained after the game. You were there, said 2.5 minute monologue about the imbalance whistles that people are thinking maybe the Pacers need to have reversed, and they are going to be submitting clips to the league that they think were unfair, which is funny because this is exactly what happened after game two against the Sixers when the whole grievance thing happened and Mark Stein had to elaborate the difference between a grievance and whatever the actual complaint was. This is stuff that that all NBA teams do all the time.
Yeah.
They do it during the regular season. They do it during the playoffs. So it's never, this is not out of the ordinary, this actual act, I want to say. But it's just interesting to me that in consecutive series against New York, their opponents, while being down 2-0, heading back home, are making it very publicly known that they are doing this very routine act that, like, there's a website. You go on and you fill it out and you click, like, it's very commonplace and very systemized. So I just found that a little bit an interesting trend so far.
I think multiple things can be true about this. One thing is that they have been disadvantaged on several calls, like, and as were the Sixers in the previous series. Tom Thibodeau's rejoinder to those things is like, show me the first 46-minute report. And I guess that's what Rick Carlisle intends to do by pulling clips from every minute of the game and showing them all, like one every other possession, it sounds like, 49 in a 91-possession game. The other side of that, though, is I think a lot of times, and, you know, whether this is, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, if you are the initial actor, if you are the aggressor, you are the team that is, you know, quote unquote, hits first, that makes that first sort of aggressive move, that is attacking the basket more often, that is whatever, the more physical team, I think you generally get a little more leeway. And I think the Knicks are built in that vein, that idea. If you are like, there plays that could be called over the back as they're going for offensive rebounds, like, but if they're the first off the floor and they're high pointing the ball, like, mm-hmm. you might get the benefit of the doubt on that. If you're, you know, the first to get, you know, that deep, to fight for deep position, and you sort of are able to dig in down there, you might get the benefit of the doubt. Like, and then the flip side, or the other component of it, is like, it's like offensive line play in the NFL, right? Like, you can call holding on every play, but they're not gonna. So like, hold. And so there's, I think everybody is, you know, digs in on their side of this sort of argument. Knicks fans are looking at it and saying, well, there's all these other plays and we could screenshot this thing. And let's also talk about Bam Adebayo's moving screens and whatever, you know, like there's always something. And then Sixers fans and Pacers fans are within their rights to complain about calls that went against them. And I think that the healthiest approach to it that I've seen came from Tyrese Halliburton and TJ McConnell, who like acknowledged this stuff. And, you know, we were asked specifically about Rick Carlisle's commentary. And is that the feeling in the locker room, that you guys also are kind of generally feeling like we're not being given a fair shot here? Our small market team is not being given a fair shake. And their response was like, no. Like, sure. I think Halliburton said, like, would we like some more consistency in some of these areas? Sure. But let's not get it twisted and act like that's the reason we lost. Like, we're getting smashed on the glass. They are imposing their will, and we need to reverse that. That's what we need to fix. And so maybe this is just all saber rattling, and it's Rick Carlisle and you know, the grand tradition of head coaches year after year after year, Phil Jackson and on forever, making a point of making a public statement to get a little more scrutiny and a little more attention on the calls, and to sway maybe one whistle or two whistles or whatever your way in the next game and try to win on the margins, because the margins matter a great deal right now. That, if that's all it is, then that's fine. I do think, though, the part where you get to 78 clips and a 2.5-minute monologue here feels a little bit closer to the we've audited the entire series Daryl Morey stuff,
yes,
that I think is not a particularly good look. But if, you know, good looks don't win you games, and if maybe a call here or there might. So, you know, certainly within Rick Carlisle's purview to do that, and, you know, the fines that he's going to get for the technical fouls, the ejections, and then what I have to imagine, implying that the NBA has a major market bias against small market teams like the Indiana Pacers.
He directly said that on the record. Specifically
and directly in a room full of reporters said, like, small, you know, no,
it's
matter
also
where,
national TV camera beamed. It's live streamed on Twitter. The clips. Yeah. It's amazing to me now. I asked Tim Cato, this is a little peek behind the curtain. I asked Tim Cato of The Athletic on Tuesday night, because I'm here in Oklahoma City after game one there, that here. I asked him if he had transcribed a particular quote from Luka, because I couldn't really hear it based off how my recorder was in the room. I asked him if he had a better transcription, because I couldn't hear it out on my recording based off of where I was in the room. And Tim just replied with a Twitter link of the video already out. And it's wild. But the Knicks have their own complaints about officiating. It's kind of like, this is an inextricably linked piece of NBA postseason stuff. The conversation is brighter on all these games, because from like another inside media baseball perspective, like, look, the game for this series in particular, like, game happened Tuesday. We talked to both coaches pregame and postgame. They both had shoot arounds yesterday. They will both talk pregame. They will have talked three times before they play another game. And all there is to do is really twist and tangle and look at every single piece of this puzzle and try to understand it in the meantime. That's what our jobs are. That's why you're listening to this podcast. That's what you want to hear. But I, with all that in mind, like I do find, and I found it since the very beginning of the NBA, when the NBA first started testing coaches' challenges in the G League, it was interesting to me. One, because I'm a big football fan, and the change of a challenge can be kind of fun and momentous, in especially because like change of possession in the NFL, obviously much more of a high stakes game than it is in the NBA. Change of possessions every 2 seconds, but there's still super critical moments in NBA games. Obviously, it's worked to the point where I remember when I was spent the night at the replay center. The fact there is a replay center is, sure, you know, what we're talking about here. And Monty McCutcheon wearing some originally crafted bow tie that he has ready to go, said to me very casually, like, "Oh yeah, our coaches love it so much, we're going to institute a second challenge next year." And just like the NFL, like if you challenge successfully, you get another one, or you retain it, whatever, however you want to look at it. I've seen people say you retain it, but to me, it's like, no, you used it. Like you already spent that dollar in your pocket. You got it. So you're getting the dollar back. Like you're not retaining it. Like you get a second one, but neither here nor there. And it was interesting to me because they first did it in the G League, where I have a lot of contacts and friends.
I was going to say merch. But yes, also merch. Contacts and friends.
Exactly. I'm trying again. I'm saying it again to a microphone and to anyone. I am looking to acquire the largest unofficial collection of official G League team gear. Please CC me and please find me on the concourse of Thomas and Mack Center. And I will gladly take your dry fit gear after you've been fired or moved on to a different opportunity. It's just the truth. It's brass tacks of it all. Okay. So I was interested by all these people who I, trying to find a different angle in Summer League, all of these coaches in the G League were explaining to me all these nuances and levels to it and when they were trying to use it and blah, 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 which at first I thought was maybe some young coaches trying to go the extra mile to prove up the ladder, hey, look at what we're doing here, blah, blah, blah. But over the years, I continued to talk about it with the coaches behind the benches who were doing this. It really is something that staffs are studying. And I thought it was really interesting to kind of notice anecdotally over the first weekend of the playoffs that teams were quicker to use their challenges in the first half of games. And so when I accumulated the data, when Yahoo Sports obtained officiating data, it was confirmed that they're up 10%. First half challenges are up 10% in the playoffs compared to the regular season. Large part because teams have gotten so good at knowing, okay, 2 seconds, we got this iPad in our lap. Here's what we're looking for on either a goaltend and out of bounds or a foul, what we think could be overturnable, reversible, whatever the terminology technically is. And we're going to call it now because we know we're right. Every little possession in these slower games that are grinding it out night after night. It's funny. I have Dan on one screen of the Riverside, and I have a box popping up on my article of you talking and you're wearing different clothes, but it's the same microphone, same background. Crazy experience right now. I'm trying to focus.
Sort of a Dan Devine or Ouroboros right there. Just like, there's a snake eating its tail, but the snake is me, and the tail is also me.
Exactly. So, especially in Philadelphia, where when I found it at the end of the first round, and this is like some Tom Haberstroh shit, but I think our listeners will like this. At the end of the first round, the Knicks were number one in total challenges with 8, number one in most successful challenges, and by estimated points, you know, from the same type of point per possession type of data that we're all trying to analyze and understand, over those 6 challenges, the Knicks saved an estimated 7.88 points, which doesn't sound like much to the casual ear, but I had several coaches text me after this article came out yesterday saying 7.8 points is a lot.
Yeah, it's massive.
And when you particularly attach that to what happened with the Knicks versus Philadelphia, because all that data was from the first round, the point differential was 1. That's a huge swing in favor of New York. It's something super, super interesting to me. I don't want to put all the attention on the referees, just like how Miles Turner said post-game that he thinks the players should be deciding these things. I agree. but it's a disposal and a tool in these coaches' toolkit on the sidelines to help just tighten a few bolts here and there to get this thing closer to a win. And the fact that Oklahoma City was number one in the league doing it this year in the regular season, 64 total challenges, 41 successful. They were a perfect 100%, 2-for-2 against New Orleans in the first round of the playoffs. I asked Dagnall about it. Coach of the year, Mark Dagnall, I should say. I should put respect on the man's name, literally, before it, pregame game one. And he said, quote, "We're looking for high leverage situations where we can try and shave points off. 2 points in the first quarter is equal to his 2 points in the fourth quarter. And so it's all about the likelihood of winning the challenge and then the impact of the play itself. That's the calculus that we're trying to get done," which sounds simple on its face, but I just think it's interesting that that's something that they're trying to do at any point in the game regardless, because the conventional wisdom was you save this until the fourth because you never know when you might need it. But
right,
the Thunder and more teams are looking at all this as much more linear, and that every play could essentially be a fourth quarter play in this type of environment. And it's just something to keep monitoring as the playoffs go along. I end my Rick Carlisle monologue on officiating, and I cede the floor to you.
No, yeah, it's, the thing that it makes me think of is like, I mean, there's a million of these sorts of examples, but that for years and years and years, you would never go to your closer in a baseball game until the ninth inning. Maybe like, you know, if you need to get the third out in the eighth, right? And then at a certain point, someone was like, well, if the most important at bat in the game is happening earlier than that, why wouldn't we go to the guy we feel most confident getting that out? Like, why would we wait? Because then, say, you know, you give up a home run in the fifth, and then you never get to the point where you can use your closer, right? That kind of situation. And so there's a million other, you know, examples of that. But the idea of these coach, especially as coaching staffs and, you know, they grow and expand as analytics departments grow and expand, as what used to be kind of like only a couple of organizations is now widespread around the league. Everyone's looking for those advantages for, you know, a possession here, a point there, you know, anything that can kind of tilt the math, even on the slightest of margins in your favor. And especially once they started giving you two, if you get one right, you get to do it again. Like that is that's a valuable weapon. And it doesn't surprise me at all that Oklahoma City, a team that, you know, has been very thoughtfully constructed, you know, in multiple iterations, and certainly this one, and with Mark Dagnall, who came out of the OKC Blue, out of the G League, and sort of the initial incubator of this system, is super conversant in that, sees the value of doing it, and that they're really good at it. A Knicks team that, it's funny, like for years we would consider the Knicks to be maybe a little behind the time or a little retrograde in terms of their front office structure, but they have beefed up their analytics program in recent years. They've added more voices there. They've added more developmental coaches and things like that there. So these teams, the teams that are ahead of these curves are going to be, you know, realizing some value in it, and that you've got two of them in the second round with an opportunity to go further than that, being sort of at the forefront of it, doesn't surprise me a whole heck of a lot.
We're going to just bounce quickly to some news, and then we're going to take an ad break to pay some bills, because you can't use a coach's challenge if you're not hired to be a coach. And the Charlotte Hornets just hired. They announced that they are hiring Charles Lee, Celtics assistant, to be the replacement for Steve Clifford and to be the first head coach of the Jeff Peterson era under this new ownership group. Charles Lee was long expected to be the outcome here. He was in Atlanta when Jeff Peterson was in Atlanta, when Rick Chennault was and Gabe Plotkin were minority owners in Atlanta. He was part of the 2021 Milwaukee Bucks championship coaching staff that, you know, had Taylor Jenkins on it, that Darvin Ham came from, of course, before he took the Lakers job. And, you know, that tree also goes back to Kenny Atkinson being on his bench in Atlanta and what have you. So one of the young guys who was in plenty of interviews, by all accounts, he had every opportunity to kind of win the Pistons coaching search last year. That it seemed, you know, Tom Gores was always just trying to go out and pursue Monty Williams to begin with, but it seemed like still that was an earnest search at a point in time.
And maybe a bullet dodged for Mr. Charles Lee.
And maybe a bullet dodged for Charles Lee. Because this is going to be like a very, from my understanding and all my conversations with the guys there, like, this is no new owner syndrome trading everything to go compete right now. Like, they know they're in a rebuild. You know, you saw that front office with the kind of transitioning Mitch Kupchak situation with, you know, a lot of direction from this ownership group pull a pretty rebuildy TM move after move at the trade deadline with Terry Rozier and getting a really, you know, pretty good first round pick value, I think, back for him. They got some stuff back for Gordon Hayward that I was a little bit like surprised they were able. I mean, they got a top two protected pick for PJ Washington from Dallas. So this is the perfect opportunity for a first time head coach. And it's something that I think is very similar to the Washington position, where that's one of the other three positions open now. The Wizards they're in their own bucket, rebuilding. A lot of thought that this could continue to stay with interim head coach Brian Keith from last year, who opposing coaching staffs definitely said good things about in terms of preparation and what they were running and blah, blah, blah. And part of that OKC tree was with the Thunder previously when Michael Winger and Will Dawkins, the new leadership there, were there. One name I've also kind of heard in the mix is a current OKC assistant, Mike Wilkes. I don't know much more than to a lot of people said to me, keep your eye on him in this conversation. So maybe that's to potentially join Brian Keefe's staff or what have you. But I think the most attention around the coaching market right now remains in LA and remains in Phoenix, where Lakers, of course, moved on from Darvin Ham. And while Frank Vogel has not had any real necessary reason from like public or like data point events that have occurred since their season lost, and Matt Ishbia said to the public that they haven't had any internal conversations about the coaching future of Frank Vogel, people are still around the league thinking and having conversations about the coaching future of Frank Vogel. I think for both these teams, as it's been well reported that we talked about before Darvin got fired, I believe on the last edition of No Cap Room, real diehards of the NCR motto would be very well aware that Ty Lue was definitely at the top of both these teams' lists for potential replacements. And the fact that he does not seem attainable from the Clippers is complicating for, I think, Phoenix in particular, being that the Lakers didn't feel any hesitation at all to not just fire Darvin Ham, but their entire coaching staff. I mean, there is a lot of movement happening right now on coaching staffs across the league. There's restructuring happening in Chicago behind Billy Donovan. Golden State has some decisions to have. I think there's stuff going on in Memphis. There's opportunities to be held with Jordy Fernandez building out a staff. Charles Lee and Charlotte now has to build out a staff. The Wizards let go of like everyone but Brian Keith and David Vanderpool from that staff. The Blazers let go of Chauncey Billups' brother and longtime head coach Scott Brooks as well. And then Chris Mannix put out something from Sports Illustrated on Twitter about Chauncey Billups being a name to keep an eye on. And I'll just say this before we go to our ad break. Chauncey Billups said to me in Charlotte, in the pregame presser, when I asked him at the end of the season in April how he would like evaluate his 2 years and what does he see for himself as a future head coach, basically in Portland or otherwise, Chauncey Billups did not hesitate either to say that he wants to be in a winning situation. And he only has 1 year left after this. Portland, I'm just going to let a little secret out. I don't think Portland's going to be challenging Minnesota or Denver or Oklahoma City for a title next year.
Might be like the only actually bad team in the West, or one of maybe two. Like, I mean, if San Antonio is going to be better, like, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, thin times in the Pacific Northwest. And if Chauncey, it's so interesting though to hear like a coach say, I want to be part of a winner, when you think of it often as like the coach being the one who shepherds the rebuild, right? And like builds you into the winner, as opposed to the coach being like, no, I want to go join up one that's already ready to go.
Well, he didn't really say that, to be
sure. Okay, right. So this is me inferring. I apologize.
Yeah. He said he wanted to have the opportunity to be part of like a winning situation. I mean, I could pull up the quote if we want to, but he definitely, because look, he got hired to coach Damian Lillard.
Right.
And he wanted to coach Damian Lillard and try to win in the playoffs. So I'm just saying, he has expressed an interest in coaching in a postseason environment. I got the link. Okay, here's the quote. Here is the quote. Again, reporting, accuracy, authenticity, being fair to our subjects, having empathy. He said, quote, "It's been a tough couple of years for us. Three now. We've just had so much influx on our roster and so much bad luck with health and things like that. And I'm just here every day, just grinding through it, helping my guys the best way I can, just hoping that hopefully the next time around, next year, we're healthy, we're better. Our roster is ready to really, really compete. Because I just know personally myself, I'm light years ahead of where I was when I took the job. Obviously, being a first-time head coach, because he was on the Clippers staff previously before getting that job, something that a lot of people in relation to Charlotte, whatever, the Lakers stuff, have suggested J.J. Redick do before he take that path, because it did help Billups to that degree. A former player does 1 year, takes those lessons, blah, blah, blah. Charles Lee getting lessons and a different staff and learning and understanding and maybe broadening his horizons in Boston for a year purportedly helps shape a greater positioning to be a head coach when you finally do get that opportunity." Back to Chauncey. Quote, "And I'm really ready for that challenge and that pressure to go out and compete with these best teams and stuff. I'm really ready to do that. So I just hope that we can be in that position. That's all." So he said we. He said we. But he also said personally he's ready to do this. And I've just heard some rumblings that he could be a name to consider for Phoenix. So I just wanted to say that into a microphone and leave that be. And we will go take our break, come back, and finish up this episode of No Cap Room. Welcome back to No Cap Room here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast. We have said goodbye to a couple of teams. We wish them well. The Milwaukee Bucks, the Philadelphia 76ers, and the Los Angeles Clippers, as well as the Orlando Magic, are four teams that super producer John Gennaro wanted us to play a game called Answer That Question to help us unpack where we are thinking and feeling about these clubs as they enter an offseason with various different questions to ask and whatnot. But John picked one question for each of them, and we're going to quickly hit them all and then get ourselves out of here. So the first question, if I'm quoting Dan Devine from Divine Intervention, not like I'm a big fan or anything. How concerned should the Bucks be about Giannis's age and postseason history? He will turn 30 in December, heading into year 12, which that means I'm heading into year 12, and that's crazy. Injuries sunk the Bucks in the playoffs the last two seasons. They've won one playoff series in 3 years since their title run. So, Dan, how concerned should the Bucks be about Giannis's age and postseason injury history? You have about 2.5 minutes. Go.
Moderately, but also, like, there's nothing you can do. Like, this is, you know, death is the high cost of living. You know, it's what's on the other side of this. Like, you have a lightning bolt that's like, you know, the magic, you know, lottery ticket that fell into your lap, and you have built everything around this guy. He literally saved your franchise. He delivered you to the promised land. You pay him as much money as humanly possible for as long as you possibly can do it. And you say, thank you for the privilege to do it. Like that Giannis has now several postseasons in a row experienced injuries in, you know, or in several of the last, you know, I think it was three of the last 4 years, injuries in a postseason setting, and been unable to finish series, been unable to even participate this year. It's a problem because everything is built around him. You know, Damian Lillard and Chris Middleton on their own are not a championship contending core with Brooke Lopez and the sort of thin roster around it. Giannis needs to be the centerpiece that everything revolves around. But, you know, you are committed to that, and you will remain committed as long as you need to. This is what you sign up for. And, you're grateful for having the opportunity, because the last time you had one of these guys, it was Kareem 50 years ago. You know, like, they don't come around that often, so hang on to him. Recognize your saints and hang on to him for as long as humanly possible.
There's definitely going to be, I mean, Stephen A. Smith's been saying all year that, like, oh, the Bucks should trade Dame wants out of Milwaukee, blah blah blah. I think there's going to be calls for that as long as Giannis is there, because and they and they continue on a similar Joel Embiid Philadelphia 76ers type postseason run after the title, because you get that glimpse, you get that taste. Like, I had the thought in that one little moment of daylight where Indy was pulling the second quarter, you know, rope away from the Knicks. I was like, man, if the Pacers win this, if Jalen Brunson's hurt, if they make the conference finals, like, what are the ramifications there? You're going to have to pay all these guys, blah, blah, blah. Like, that is how this stuff, and then the expectations are there. So you win the title and you're supposed to be more than this for sure. But to everything you said, I think this group is pretty locked in. Like, Milwaukee and John Horst has definitely been a name that people have been wondering about for the Pistons. He's from the area. I believe he was part of that organization at one point in time. I don't have anything further to say at this point, but it just, as of my latest calls around the league this week, it does seem like that is not going to be something to keep you keeping an eye on. But then again, like, Monty Williams turned down the job 17 times or whatever before the check was finally big enough for him to take it. So I'm not ready to end any name on this situation and story. But the impression right now is that Horst seems to be along for the ride in Milwaukee. I've been told that for a little while, that like, this guy's super committed to this build and he's got a whole front office that like treat this guy like a creative rock star. And he kind of has been to some degree turning lemons into lemonade, or, you know, whatever analogy you want to use for taking whatever draft capital you have left and Grayson Allen and Drew Holiday and deciding like, we need to get someone who's one of the baddest half court postseason playmakers possible. And you get Dame Lillard, who showed exactly why you get him in game one of the Pacers. And Giannis's health obviously is the reason why they were not able to contend, which is why this question is being posed, John. I get it. But this team seems along for this ride in particular. I don't know this next thing I'm going to say to be like true, but if there's anything that I think the Bucks would be concerned by, and someone with an injury history, I wouldn't be surprised if we hear that Milwaukee's looking at things for Chris Middleton this summer. I'm not reporting that. I'm just saying, right, knowing past history and knowing some of the types of players that are going to be available, you know, like, let's say the Magic, for example, strike out on all these guards that they're being linked to. He's someone who has a lot of history with, you know, the former Bucks people that are in that organization. So that's something that I think would be possible, but not Giannis.
And also just contractually, like, every core member, you know, Giannis, Dame, Middleton, Brooke Lopez, Bobby Portis, Pat Connaughton, like, those guys are all under contract, fully guaranteed for next season, right? But Giannis has an extension going beyond, there's several years beyond. Dame Lillard's extension goes beyond. Chris Middleton has a player option in 2025-26. So, like, if you were going to move on from one of those guys and you wanted to keep your Giannis Dame window open another year, where can you move around it? Brooke Lopez is going to be is slated for unrestricted free agency in 25-26. Middleton has the player option for 25-26. Bobby Portis, player option 25-26. Connaughton, player option 25-26. So that feels like your sort of natural pivot point heading into that year. Those sorts of deadlines lead to action in advance of them, which would be, you know, this coming season. So yeah, could certainly see that, but could also absolutely see, like, if you are John Horst and you are sticking around and you are that front office who was part of building this championship team, saying like, we're going to give this core that gave us this championship, this core four guys, and with Bobby Portis added into there, Connaughton to some degree, maybe added into there, like, give those guys, you know, the chance to get one more healthy run at it and see what it looks like. Because when they had their main four guys on their roster, they were, you know, a wrecking crew this season. They still were at, it was like 14 or 15 points per 100 possessions. They were outscoring teams by, like, it still looked good. And Middleton, by the end of the year, by the end of the postseason series, was actually, like, as healthy as he's been in a while and producing at a superstar kind of level. You know, if you get everybody healthy and on the same page start next season, you know, maybe those expectations that you had coming into this year, you're able to actually fulfill them.
Yeah. On to Philly. What is the right kind of player to add to this team? And I think this is a really interesting question because, you know, the Paul George stuff has been out there. I mean, I think we first wrote that in a notebook at like the end of the trade deadline, like, sweeping up the dust and picking up the pieces and see what could forecast ahead. And Paul George to Philly has been a thing for a while now in the rumor mill. Paul George to Orlando has come up of late. You know, there's been thought of him potentially reuniting with Indiana. I mean, Paul George could fit anywhere, which is part of why he could be the obvious answer in Philadelphia. My one thing, though, is that to me, if you're looking around the league right now, most of these teams are really built off of like two main offensive hubs, and everyone else is a complementary piece to that. And sure, you don't have, it's not like how a team has to be built, right? Like Boston, you could look at all six of their starters as like hubs of their offense, you know? And Porzingis does a whole different thing about stretching their floor and his size and what have you. But to me, like, just looking at the depth that Philly was struggling with against New York, and we just did a whole like 20-minute segment at the top about how their depth really isn't anything to be so proud of right now, that like, to me, I would rather split their $60 million in space on like three real dudes as opposed to one 34-year-old guy with his own injury history.
Yeah.
Who has his own past postseason, you know, checkered history.
Oh, playoff so, P? Talking about our guy, Playoff P?
Talking about Playoff P. I've been banging the table for like, you go out and get KCP. You go out and overpay a backup center who could maybe even play some double big lineups. Like, I don't know if I've said this on the pod. I really don't remember. I was thinking about Isaiah Hartenstein for them during the Knicks series.
He has made himself a lot of money this season in this playoffs.
Yes. Something maybe to write about later. I have some thoughts and details there. But yeah, my thing is go get your real two-way. Go get your KCP for Denver, which he'll be available. Go get that backup center. Go get that connective four-man who does everything that you would want Tobias Harris to do. And better spend your resources that way. I don't think there's the right kind of player to add to this team. My argument is break that omelet into three eggs.
Okay. That's, yeah. I don't know if that's
how trying to make you laugh. I was trying to make you laugh.
Okay. Like, hang on. I haven't cooked in a little bit, but I think that, I think omelets work a little differently. Obviously, Jake, I cook every goddamn time.
Make three eggs. Make an omelet with three eggs.
Then break it up. Then deconstruct the omelet.
One.
Deconstruct it. There you go. Obviously, also just to finish that thought, I cook every time I sit down at the goddamn keyboard and the microphone. So I've been cooking. What I would say, I think if you were just like, if you were looking for one thing, one player to fit between Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey, yeah, Paul George would be, it'd be pretty hard to draw up or sketch out a better fit where it's like big wing size, multi-positional defender, elite movement shooter, guy who can run pick and roll, but doesn't need to be like a 70 touches a game guy, 80 touches a game guy, kind of fits in everywhere. It's why Paul George, you know, there was that story, I think it was Omyung Masuk at ESPN wrote the like why Paul George is sort of everybody's goat now and why he's the iconic build, because he fits everywhere. He's like frictionless addition. So from a
skill set is different than the player though.
Yes, right. And so like if you were looking to add a skill set between those two guys, that checks off pretty much every box. This particular package, though, is 34 years old. You'd be paying like $212 million through the 38 season for somebody who I think four of the last five seasons had missed significant time to injury and load management, et cetera. And as you mentioned, it's not exactly like he has had soaring postseason highs, but it's not like confirmed consistent riser. And in an environment where obviously postseason trauma and psychosis is, you know, the rule rather than the exception, you could just really close your eyes and envision Paul George in Philadelphia going horrendously. But you're right. I mean, like, I think if you are able to, I guess my challenge here is that I don't know when I look at it and say, who are the three guys between the age range that are also the right positional fit, that are also two-way players that you feel confident are going to be able to be on the floor in high leverage situations, et cetera. Like it's hard to find one of those guys, let alone three, especially in a free agency class that might not be particularly redolent with talent given all the extensions that have been out there before. But You know, certainly Daryl Morey in that front office will be, you know, doing their due diligence on all of it. I think that my bet would be Daryl Morey wants to go get a star more than Daryl Morey wants to get three role players.
Yeah, I agree. But, he said that basically.
Yeah, but I get your point. I think, and especially as we're seeing, we get to this time of year, like the war of attrition, like the more healthy quality bodies you can throw at problems, the better. And as we've seen also with like the way Oklahoma City has been playing, the way Minnesota has been playing, the younger you can get in those spots, the better, because old guys get hurt this time of year.
Yeah. No, I think the question is what would we do, not what we thought Daryl Morey would do, which is why I was providing that perspective. Because Paul George is definitely, to me, if I could look into my crystal ball and see into Daryl's thoughts, it would be Paul George, Paul George, Paul George. That'd be my thought. That'd be my thought, what his thought is. But like my fears about it are because like the next question here is the Clippers. Was it over then and is it over now? Which is pretty sweet and sentimental, because like I think it's over, man. The thought of like we are championship contenders, all the picks are worth it to OKC because you get to marry Paul with Kawhi and James Harden's going to take us over the stretch. We're going to be a real title team going into the Intuit Dome with all the toilets. I just
sorry, it took me a second, but yeah, so many toilets.
That enthusiasm to me isn't there anymore. That's not to say they're not going to end up with Paul, Kawhi, and Harden all back, and they're going to run this thing back, and they could win the damn thing. But to me, like, there is no way to have any type of confidence that all three of those dudes are going to be healthy and performing at maximum capacity in the playoffs together. It has never happened to this point. It's been a half decade of that, and to expect anything otherwise, I think, would kind of be crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I go back and forth with this sometimes with our friend Michael Pina from The Ringer. He is one of the foremost Clippers believers. He goes after, he's going to go kick that football. Lucy's going to keep it down there this time. And every year I'm like, I'd rather be a year late to this. Like, I need to see it to believe it, because I've seen it in several different forms and functions fall apart at exactly the time when it's all supposed to be coming together. The fact that they signed the Kawhi Leonard extension for, it's like 3 years, 150, right? Something like that, or around there, 149.
153,
Somewhere around
150.
Plus or minus, yeah, somewhere around there. And that he hasn't finished a season healthy since the bubble, I think. Where they collapsed against Denver, but at least he made it to the end of the series. And so I understood why you would do it, but to come out of the season with Paul George not extended, James Harden having turned, you know, had a representative James Harden postseason performance, and now neither of those guys are locked up under contract, and retaining them is going to cost you, you know, an arm and a leg to do it, and you are so limited in your flexibility because you've locked yourself into this Kawhi contract extended out several years. And like, so even if you were of a mind to say, we're going to dynamite this thing and try to move Kawhi, like of what value are you going to return for Kawhi Leonard at this point when no one's seen him finish a season in 4 years? And at best you see him be like resembling the fires of old for 30 games, but that's about it. Right. And so like past that, Where do you go to get something? Like, yeah, you know, Ivica Zubats and Terrence Mann and Norm Powell, those guys are expiring contracts this year. This is the last year of their deals. Okay, yeah, I mean, it could probably return some value if you wanted to move off of it there. But it feels like everybody's sort of entombed together. Like they made a pact, and they're all gonna go down with the ship. Like, Kawhi gets the deal. I mean, maybe Paul George is the exception to that rule, but like, I don't know where the landing spot for James Harden is, if not for that. We've already covered in many capacities the lack of infinite wiggles that he has. And so like, it does feel like their only thing to do is pay everybody if they will take the money and keep him around and just, you know, like, hope for something better than what you got this time around. Hope that next year is finally the time Kawhi's healthy. And the hope is not a plan, but I don't know what the plan is outside of that.
Yeah. I think we will find out pretty soon, depending on how Paul George's free agency develops, number one. And if Orlando is an outcome, that would be one interesting piece of context to consider for our last question, which is from super producer John Gennaro. Is it Anthony Black time with the Magic?
Yeah, my answer to that was another question was like, is Anthony Black going to be a player who could take more than like a three a game and that like entirely unguarded threes a game? Because if Anthony Black can shoot, then yes, it needs to be Anthony Black time immediately. Whoever can shoot, it needs to be their time there. I don't know. Like, is Mark Price available? Can we get, is Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf? Can he come into the gym? Like, somebody who can shoot. The Magic finished the regular season dead last in three-point makes per game, 29th in three-point attempts per game, 24th in three-point percentage as a team, and 27th in the share of their shots that came from three-point land. Like, they need shooting. And so it's why, you know, George can make sense in that capacity. Middleton, as you mentioned, the name, and I mean, it's a name that I have heard kicked around. I kind of like the idea because I don't know that you're necessarily outside of, I mean, Jalen Suggs, good money. Like we've locked, he is extended. He belongs. He has proven that he should be a foundational piece, like the only real foundational piece in that backcourt that I feel like you can feel confident in. What would it take to get Ant Simons out of Portland? Because you're talking about like shooter, right? In a congested backcourt mix in Portland, a team that might, you know, may or may not really be going much anywhere. And if I'm Orlando and I've got like some recent lottery guards and I've got some, you know, surplus bigs and, you know, I've got long limbed guys of different sizes and shapes and I've got some draft capital to use, like, I would take a flyer on something like that, I think. But
it's really interesting. I mean, I don't think that is where it's going to head at this juncture. They seem to be a team looking to just spend, but you can acquire someone into that cap space and he'd be a dude. Cause like kind of like the Philly question with what's the ideal third person there? Like Orlando does need some type of, Franz and Paolo have kind of figured out a little pick and roll connectivity on one side of the floor. To me, obviously Franz, and this is tough for me to say as a big fan of both Wagner brothers, Franz did not look good, did not play well throughout most of the first round, definitely had a total goose egg in game 7, but I believe, and I was really encouraged to see how fluid those guys were when like Franz would looking very Hedo Turkoglu to Rashard Lewis. I can't get that like similarity out of my head when I watch them play because they're both enormous and bring the ball up off the glass like those guys did. They're missing Dwight Howard, but it's fine. Like the way Franz would find Powell on the block extended, and if Powell couldn't have his array of I'm doing one dribble and just getting by you, what he can do with most players, which is crazy because he's a second-year guy, but he's massive. They have such a nice rhythm to him kicking it back out to Franz, and Powell has become such a willing screener for them. But like, they need someone else, not just a shooter on the other side who is a threat to shoot without a doubt, who is a dangerous threat to shoot, but then can do something with it too. So Simons would be awesome in that role. And I'd love that. I mean, I'd love Malik Monk there in a similar capacity. Like to me, that's what I would like Orlando to do more than like a Klay Thompson, which Chris Middleton, to our earlier point, I think he could provide similar type, but obviously much different end of the age spectrum. And sure, Simons is really kind of spicy, honestly, with the age range and the timeline or anything there.
Yeah. I can see if you're Portland saying like, well, we're still kind of percolating on all this. Like we don't really know exactly what we want to have and where we want to have it and who
it's going to cost a lot to get.
Yeah. So that's like, what's the sort of price point in the let's make a deal there, I think. And I'm terrible at fake trades, so I don't have a good one handy. But I feel like that's one where I'm like, if what are the assets going back? And like, is that what would be worth Portland's while. I would call. Yeah. I would at least call if I was Orlando.
You have to call.
And I understand I would understand, like, they have sort of a type, and it's, you know, the like long rangy physical, and that's not who Ant Simons is. But like, you do wonder if it's a little bit like, well, I've got 9 offensive linemen. I need a running back, you know, yeah. Or like I need somebody that I need the skill position player to go make the play. If not the one that I came up with, that like that's what I keep, like, Anthony yeah. Black, I think there's a lot to like there. You know, high level connector, guy who fits defensively, seems like he should be getting more than 1,100 minutes next year and whatever their plans are. Mm-hmm. What happens with Jet Howard? Who knows? Basically a lost season for him. You know, the Fultz question hangs over them. There's a lot to figure out. But to me, I don't think it would necessarily be like, well, we finally were halfway decent. Let's all push all chips into the middle. I don't think that's what you're necessarily need to do. I think there might be a middle path where you can find if there is a middle path where you find someone roughly age appropriate along the timeline who checks some different boxes than what you've already got. I think that would be worth maybe pushing some of those chips into the middle for. But that, you know, Orlando has been sort of a patient front office, so we'll see you know, how aggressive they're interested in being.
Well, we were not quick with this game at all.
Yeah, sorry.
And shout out to anyone who said me say, oh, we're going to do this quickly when there was like 20 minutes left on your podcast number. That's all we got for you. Yeah, I think the Anthony Black question is interesting because he was the number 6 overall pick. And there were questions at the time of using that, like, oh, what are you doing taking him when you have Jalen Suggs and you have Markelle Fultz and you have Cole Anthony? So it is an interesting question that I will be curious to see how it all unfolds. And that is really all we've got for you today. Thanks to super producer John Gennaro, who does all the things to make the show look and sound great and provide us 4 questions to answer about playoff eliminated peeps. Subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on and leave us a 5-star review. We thank you for listening. And we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.